Hello, you with Truth News. It's Sunday, the 27th of September 2009. My name's Hereward Fenton, and you're listening to an Australian-made podcast. And today we bring you The Twilight of Freedom, a special feature, a montage of tyranny as the world sinks into a new frightening era of totalitarianism and repression.
By order of the City of Pittsburgh Chief Police, I hereby declare this to be an unlawful assembly. I order all those assembled to immediately disperse. You must leave the immediate vicinity.
Anybody got an idea?
If you remain in this immediate vicinity, you will be in violation of the Pennsylvania Crimes Code. No matter what your purpose is, you must leave. If you do not disperse, you may be arrested and or subject to other police action. Other police action may include actual physical removal, the use of riot control agents and or less lethal munitions,
You're listening there to some sounds from the G20 protest in Pittsburgh in the United States last week. We'll be bringing you some more highlights from the protest and also some clips from a ominous statement and warning from three world leaders regarding Iran. And we'll be looking at the phenomenon of tyranny as it spreads its arms around the globe, and the way in which we're becoming conditioned and acclimatized to accept it. I hope you enjoy the show.
Look right here on the sidewalk. Police are forcing these cyclists to move. I'm, she just threw her bike at an officer. An officer is taking her down. She is being taken down and arrested at this point. You're looking live right now at an arrest. She threw her bike to the, up at a police officer, and the police officer is forcing her to move.
Police used tear gas, pepper spray, rubber bullets, and sonic weapons against University of Pittsburgh students during the Pittsburgh G20 summit. Many of the students were not part of any demonstration, but merely bystanders, curious to find a mass of armed riot police on their campus. You can see heavily armored carriers moving around. We can see police in science fiction outfits, and we have that audio which we heard earlier. It was during the day of the police ordering people to disperse. The sound you hear there is the sound of tear gas canisters being fired at the completely unarmed and peaceful crowd of university students who are actually merely observing what is going on the street.
I'm speechless. I am.
Yo, I got the grenade. This is the grenade that they're throwing at us. It says, what is that? 6240AOCZV aerosol grenade.
We weren't riding, we were sitting there in the William Pitt Union lawn, our own union. That's where they take us down, our own union. Just sitting there, doing nothing wrong.
Shit! Holy shit, dude, they were spraying pepper spray at us. How is a student?
In the video accompanying this audio, you can see quite clearly that the people who are being pushed back by the police are not even protesters. There we see the police in their science fiction outfits, all in black, faces completely obscured. More tear gas being fired.
What's your name, dude? What's your name?
Get back.
Hey, dude, shout out your name. What's your name?
Get back.
We have random attacks from police against protesters and bystanders. That's the sonic weapon being deployed there.
Injury to those who remain. No matter what your purpose is, you must leave. If you do not disperse, you may be arrested and or subject to other police action.
Munitions, which could cause risk of injury to those who remain. By order of the City of Pittsburgh Chief Police, I hereby declare this to be an unlawful assembly.
We now see the police advancing
to immediately disperse
in full battle armor.
On top of that.
They're macing the people on top of course.
Where the fuck are we supposed to go?
This is the face of pure tyranny. We see a young woman being pushed with a young man with a phalanx of police directly in front of them. They appear to be trying to talk to the police. Now, the police grab the young woman and I think they're saying beat her. And you can see them pushed to the ground and she's now completely hidden by a crowd of policemen.
Excuse me, could you explain the reasons for all of this, sir? What's happening? Sir, could you explain what's happening? Why we have to disperse?
You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia, going beyond the spin, deception and propaganda of mainstream news. Visit truthnews.com.au and subscribe now. While the police in Pittsburgh were busily trampling on the rights of peaceful protesters, the leaders of the free world inside the conference were busily beating the drums of war against Iran, a nation which has never been an aggressor against another country.
President Obama today criticized Iran for concealing the existence of a nuclear facility used to enrich uranium. The president called for immediate inspections of the facility. He was joined by British Prime Minister Gordon Brown and French President Nicolas Sarkozy. This took place at the G20 summit in Pittsburgh.
Good morning. We are here to announce that yesterday in Vienna, the United States, the United Kingdom, and France presented detailed evidence to the IAEA demonstrating that the Islamic Republic of Iran has been building a covert uranium enrichment facility near Qom for several years. Earlier this week, the Iranian government presented a letter to the IAEA that made reference to a new enrichment facility years after they had started its construction. The existence of this facility underscores Iran's continuing unwillingness to meet its obligations under UN Security Council resolutions and IAEA requirements. We expect the IAEA to immediately investigate this disturbing information and to report to the IAEA Board of Governors. Now, Iran's decision to build yet another nuclear facility without notifying the IAEA represents a direct challenge to the basic compact at the center of the nonproliferation regime. These rules are clear. All nations have the right to peaceful nuclear energy. Those nations with nuclear weapons must move towards disarmament. Those nations without nuclear weapons must forsake them. That compact has largely held for decades, keeping the world far safer and more secure. And that compact depends on all nations living up to their responsibilities. This site deepens a growing concern that Iran is refusing to live up to those international responsibilities, including specifically revealing all nuclear-related activities. As the international community knows, this is not the first time that Iran has concealed information about its nuclear program. Iran has a right to peaceful nuclear power that meets the energy needs of its people. But the size and configuration of this facility is inconsistent with a peaceful program. Iran is breaking rules that all nations must follow, endangering the global nonproliferation regime, denying its own people access to the opportunity they deserve, and threatening the stability and security of the region and the world. It is time for Iran to act immediately to restore the confidence of the international community by fulfilling its international obligations. We remain committed to serious, meaningful engagement with Iran to address the nuclear issue through the P5+1 negotiations. Through this dialogue, we are committed to demonstrating that international law is not an empty promise, that obligations must be kept, and the treaties will be enforced. And that's why there's a sense of urgency about the upcoming meeting on October 1st between Iran, the permanent members of the UN Security Council, and Germany. At that meeting, Iran must be prepared to cooperate fully and comprehensively with the IAEA to take concrete steps to create confidence and transparency in its nuclear program and to demonstrate that it is committed to establishing its peaceful intentions through meaningful dialogue and concrete actions. To put it simply, Iran must comply with UN Security Council resolutions and make clear it is willing to meet its responsibilities as a member of the community of nations. We have offered Iran a clear path toward greater international integration if it lives up to its obligations, and that offer stands. But the Iranian government must now demonstrate through deeds its peaceful intentions or be held accountable to international standards and international law. I should point out that although the United Kingdom, France, and the United States made the presentation to Vienna, that Germany, a member of the P5+1, and Chancellor Merkel in particular, who could not be here this morning, wished to associate herself with these remarks. I would now like to turn to President Sarkozy of France for a brief statement.
Mesdames et messieurs.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have met yesterday for a meeting, a summit meeting of the Security Council on disarmament and nuclear disarmament. I repeated my conviction that Iran was taking the international community on a dangerous path. I have recalled all the attempts that we have made to offer a negotiated solution to the Iranian leaders without any success, which what has been revealed today is exceptional. Following the enriching plant of Natanz in 2002, it is now the Khon one which is revealed. It was designed and built over the past several years in direct violation of resolutions from the Security Council and from the IAEA. I am expecting from the IAEA an exhaustive, strict and rigorous investigation, as President Obama just said. We were already in a very severe confidence crisis. We are now faced with a challenge made to the entire international communities. The six will meet with the Iranian representatives in Geneva. Everything must be put on the table now. We cannot let Iranian leaders gain time while the motors are running. If by December there is not an in-depth change by the Iranian leaders, sanctions will have to be taken. This is for the peace and stability. Thank you.
America, the United Kingdom, and France are at one. Iran's nuclear program is the most urgent proliferation challenge that the world faces today. As President Obama and President Sarkozy have just said, the level of deception by the Iranian government and the scale of what we believe is the breach of international commitments will shock and anger the whole international community, and it will harden our resolve. Confronted by the serial deception of many years, the international community has no choice today but to draw a line in the sand. On October the 1st, Iran must now engage with the international community and join the international community as a partner. If it does not do so, it will be further isolated. And I say on behalf of the United Kingdom today, we will not let this matter rest, and we are prepared to implement further and more stringent sanctions. Let the message that goes out to the world be absolutely clear, that Iran must abandon any military ambitions for its nuclear program. Thank you.
After this statement by the three great leaders from three of the great and free democracies in the world, the Iranian president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, responded. And among his statements was an interesting point. He said, how do these countries have the authority to say to Iran, you must do this and you must do that?
Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad responded to President Obama's statement, saying his country's nuclear program is in full compliance with international rules. President Ahmadinejad spoke with reporters following the UN General Assembly meeting in New York. This portion is about 5 minutes.
That Mr. Obama, along with Mr. Sarkozy and Mr. Brown, have spoken about Iran. I'd like to point to a few issues here. Iran's activities with respect to the peaceful use of nuclear technology are completely within the framework of IAEA rules and under its supervision. Today I was quite surprised and couldn't understand really whether we're supposed to inform the IAEA of our activities or not in the end of the day. Well, according to the regulations that have been laid out, every enrichment facility that is created must, within 6 months before it is infused with gas, be known of by the IAEA, by the risk country that has begun the operation of this facility. Now, we still have a year left before that first six-month deadline kicks in. Now, instead of 6 months, we actually informed the agency 18 months ahead of time. Now, is this the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do? I thought we're supposed to be encouraged for taking this action. I didn't know that a group of people should come together and just start voicing out a concern against us. Now, this was the first point I wanted to make. What we did was completely legal according to the law. We have informed the agency. The agency will come and take a look and produce a report, and it's nothing new. Since previous years, we have actually done the same thing, carried out the same process in our cooperative efforts with the IAEA. Now, second point is that those who thought that they could take sort of the occasion of the United Nations meeting and the occasion of people being here in New York to turn the atmosphere around against the Iranian nation, but failed, probably thought to themselves that they had a winning card here and they could kind of make some noise and then start commanding. Iran must do so and so. Iran must do this and that. We're saying, what business of yours is it to tell us what we must do or not? You're just another country, a member state of the IAEA like any other one. So the positions that were taken today, which we saw, is quite different from the remarks made by Mr. Obama at the United Nations. He correctly said that we must not move ahead based on speculations. We must not unnecessarily accuse one another. Now, tell me what was done today. What exactly does that mean? They must not interfere in the activities of the IAEA. They must give the IAEA enough time to go check things out, prepare its reports, and then provide the information to all the relevant bodies and organizations that are involved. Now, it seems to me that what was done was a really big mistake. Now, when the IAEA report finally comes out, I'm sure they'll definitely feel sorry about their move. I think they already probably regret it and will be regretting it more down the road, because in the end of the day, this is a very ordinary facility that has been set up, and it's only in the beginning stages, and we still have a month before that final deadline where we've informed everyone, and it's not a secret facility. If it was, why did we inform the IAEA a year ahead of time? And we've got the
Meanwhile, the Australian Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd, addressed the Carnegie Mellon Institute in Pittsburgh with a speech focused on climate change, in which he emphasised that our approach must be grounded in the science.
Climate change indeed represents a great long-term threat to our planet. The agreed science warns us that the impact from climate change will be a clear threat to nations. By 2020, between 75 and 250 million people in Africa could be exposed to climate change-induced water shortages. Rain-fed agriculture yields may drop by up to 50% in some African countries. By 2050, rising sea levels could directly affect more than 1 million people in the river delta regions of Bangladesh, Vietnam, and Egypt. Sea levels could rise by a metre or more, over 3 feet, by 2100. If the world does not act by the year 2100, global temperatures could rise by up to 6.4 degrees Celsius, that's more than 10 degrees Fahrenheit. These impacts will be felt right across the world. No respecter of nations, no respecter of peoples. Definitionally, a global challenge demanding a global response. But in areas like the Pacific Ocean, where many small island states sit only metres above the sea level, the impacts will be more immediate and more devastating. Without global action, the economic impacts of climate change will be substantial. Nicholas Stern found that doing nothing to address climate change will result in costs equivalent to reducing economic welfare by between 5 and 20% per person now and forever. What does all this mean? It means, first and foremost, that we, the community of nations, must act. There is an overwhelming environmental and economic urgency to act on climate change. What we need to do is limit the amount of carbon getting into the atmosphere. According to the 4,000-member International Panel on Climate Change Scientists, one of whom I had the great privilege of meeting here this evening, a distinguished member of your faculty, Its panel's report, agreed to by all governments, concluded that we need to stabilise the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere at 450 parts per million or lower, and we need to take action to limit the rise in temperatures to less than 2 degrees Celsius. Our response as a community of nations and as the economies of the world must be grounded in the science.
When you're sick of the propaganda, when you're over the disinformation, when you can't stand the deception, when the deceit gets too much, when the spin becomes transparent, you know where to turn. You turn on truthnews.com.au with your hosts, Harold Fenton and Joshua Jackson.
Shall be relieved.
And that was Joan Baez singing a song by Bob Dylan, I Shall Be Released. Okay, well, next up is more tyranny, more Big Brother, literally this time. We're going to bring you some audio from 60 Minutes episode, which was aired last week on Australian television. And it's all about literally Big Brother. And you can, I guess, make what you will of it. It appears to be done with some level of journalistic integrity. I think Channel 9 has been careful to present the information in a way which could be interpreted as either pro or against. Anyway, here it is, for what it's worth.
Welcome to the future, a world of global high-tech surveillance where no one can hide. Whether you're innocent or guilty, the authorities can keep tabs on you. Use a credit card, drive down to the shops, log on to your computer. Chances are, someone's watching you. And that's just the beginning. You'll be horrified at what they already know, what they'll be able to find out about you. In Middlesbrough, England, you don't dare step out of line.
Could the young lady in the dark coloured jacket and the light coloured trousers please pick your cup up and put it in the rubbish bins provided?
Here, the town's 150,000 citizens are not only under 24-hour surveillance, they're being publicly shamed into minding their manners.
Thank you.
21 of the town's 200 CCTV cameras have speakers. And from what looks like mission control, the stern voice of authority rings out like a vigilant parent.
Please remember to put your visit in the rubbish bins provided.
Or you could face a fine of £80. Remember
the CCTV app monitoring. Thank you.
It really is a step up from monitoring to Big Brother.
It has become a name and shame, and people don't like being pointed out.
So public humiliation works?
Yes,
it does. That's what you're doing?
Virtually, yes. But don't forget, littering is a crime.
You're publicly slapping them?
You could say that, yes.
Is it official? Big Brother has arrived?
I think it has arrived. In a way, we're living in a science fiction future, but most of us don't realise that it's happened or the speed of technology which has enabled it to happen.
Never in history have our private lives been more publicly observed. From CCTV to the internet, our every move can be tracked. But we've always been told Big Brother was there to protect us. Surveillance certainly makes us feel safer and has solved crimes that would otherwise have gone unsolved.
I think if you went through life never knowing what had actually happened, as some people do, I think that would be terrible, that would be worse.
If it wasn't for technology, Estella and John Aparis-Price may never have seen justice for their son Tom. This is the last time Tom, a 31-year-old lawyer, was seen alive.
They'd been working and he'd been for a drink with some friends afterwards, just to wrap up really, and so he got the tube train back to where he lived with his girlfriend.
Tom never made it. He was stabbed to death by two of these gang members for £20, a mobile phone, and his train card.
How has life changed?
You know, somehow when Tom came home, our family kind of felt complete. I don't know how to say it. So that's always around.
Tom's train card was the key to tracking down his killers. You see, each one of these is embedded with an identification chip, storing the details of its owner. So when Tom's murderers used this card, they were effectively leading the police to them.
This is the morning after Tom has been murdered, and he's gone to the same train station. And what you can see here is that he's tried to use the card.
Combining all available technologies, it took just 6 days for Detective Chief Superintendent Julian Worker to catch Tom's killers. Further CCTV checks revealed the same men had committed hundreds of robberies in a six-month crime spree. Once he does that, you then know that that's Tom's card, do you?
We've got the usage time. We've then married the two together with the CCTV.
So without him even realising, he's starting to give himself up?
Absolutely.
The beauty of technology.
It does help, and certainly helped in this investigation.
Mm. But these days, you don't have to be a criminal to be under observation. Every one of us is constantly monitored every day of our lives. And Australia is only just catching up to places like the UK. It's estimated that every time a Londoner steps outside, they're monitored by surveillance cameras up to 300 times a day. The UK is the most watched place in the world, with nearly 5 million CCTVs. That's about one camera for every 12 people.
I'm horrified.
So you're saying to me that what started out as a reasonable thing to do has crept much further. It's by stealth come under the door.
Yeah, and I just think, how dare they?
Author Henry Porter is one of many who believe the intrusion of everyday surveillance has gone too far.
There are cameras over there. Behind us is a globe camera. Probably cameras down that street.
I have no objection to a surveillance camera in an underground, you know, underpass or in a car park or anything, because it protects people. It actually does deter crime, and I have no contest with that. But I mean, the current year, we've got about 1 in 17 people in the whole British population, so that includes children as well, have been under some kind of official surveillance. That means emails intercepted, phone calls intercepted, maybe some sort of discreet watch on their house and their movements.
Did you say 1 in 17?
1 in 17.
If you think that's extraordinary, it's nothing to what the future may hold. It won't matter where you are in the world. The era of global surveillance is upon us, and there'll be nowhere to hide.
Here's the whole world, and the nice thing about this is I can spin the world like that. And here, why don't we go to where you guys are in Sydney, right?
From an office in Boston, Adam Bogue is using his diamond touch table to show me how satellite surveillance could potentially pinpoint any of us anywhere on Earth.
Look at that. The heart of Sydney, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And it's as simple as that. It's just the touch of a fingertip, isn't it?
Once on the ground, CCTV cameras could take over to track an individual on the street. Then, face recognition technology would identify who you are and everything about you.
So from the video footage, we can extract their facial appearance and also their facial shape, and then match that to a database of shapes and appearances that we would have. And if there is a match, we would obviously find who that person is.
At Boston's Cambridge University, Hans-Peter Pfister is developing 3D face recognition so sophisticated, it will soon be possible to create a database of all of us, made from the happy snaps we post on sites like Facebook.
not Big Brother?
Obviously, everybody is afraid of Big Brother. That is absolutely true. I think Big Brother is already happening. The question is, how do we deal with it? And what policies do we have so that we can still maintain the little privacy that we do have?
All the technology we've seen could one day converge at a central control point like this, the New York Police Department's real-time crime center.
It truly does look a bit like we'd seen in the movies.
Yeah,
in this futuristic headquarters, the latest surveillance and information technologies come together.
We'll do a background check on him anyway.
This, to me, is really one of the most exciting things that we have going within the police department. First high-tech crime-fighting system out there.
Inspector Kenneth McKeel and his team can combine satellite and CCTV footage with phone or medical records, cross-reference internet details with criminal histories.
CCTV, satellite, you're able to pull all these things in if you need to.
Correct. If you see, we get actual live feeds, you know, out in the field, we can see what's going on.
This is the 21st century.
This is the real thing. I've been many years, close to 30 years on this job, and I was in the day of carbon paper and a lot of loose papers and computer systems that didn't work together well, and it was a lot of footwork. We're eliminating time, and we're locking people up that really deserve to be locked up.
The result? In the last 5 years, murders in New York have dramatically dropped from 2,000 a year to 500. But Henry Porter wonders how much of our privacy we've surrendered for success like that.
Is it a case now that we're all under suspicion?
Yeah, there is now this strange conversion which happened, which is that you now, the citizen, has to prove him or herself to the state endlessly, rather than the state assuming that the citizen is basically well-intentioned and innocent. Raise your hands up in
the air! But some citizens are embracing the age of Big Brother. In Rotterdam, Holland, nightclub owner John Van Gallen has introduced a system of microchipping for his VIP patrons. It's almost like barcoding people.
Yeah, it is. Because every chip got a number, and the number corresponds to the name and the picture. That's the way it is, yeah. It is.
The microchip has to be surgically inserted under the skin, which means you'll have to have it cut out if you want it removed.
Did it hurt getting the chip in? Okay, can I have a look?
Yeah, of course.
It feels like a little grain of rice.
It's a rice, yeah.
Irving has had the chip for the past 4 years. Every time he buys a drink, he's scanned. And, like a human ATM, money comes off his account.
You don't feel like you're giving up a little bit of your privacy, do you?
No. Yeah.
It's nice to have. You can say, I have a chip in my arm. I'm the first one in all the world. I have a chip. Yeah.
Remember CCTV and monitoring. Thank you.
Big Brother is here to stay. And in Middlesbrough, it's something the locals have learned to live with. Jack Bonner argues it's changed community behaviour and made his town a better place.
We are not here to infringe your liberty. We're not interested in infringing your privacy. We won't be looking through your bedroom window or your living room window.
People do not understand that this is happening to them. It's like growing old, you know, you don't often realize it. And I think it will be, you know, a decade before we really understand how our society's changed.
Now we bring you some words from Zbigniew Brzezinski, Obama's top foreign policy advisor, from a speech given on November 17th, 2008.
For the first time in human history, for the first time in all of human history, almost all of mankind is politically awake. And these new and old major powers face still yet another novel reality, in some respects unprecedented. And it is that while the lethality of their power is greater than ever, their capacity to impose control over the politically awakened masses of the world is at a historical low. I once put it rather pungently, and I was flattered that the British Foreign Secretary repeated this, as follows. Namely, in earlier times, it was easier to control a million people, literally. It was easier to control a million people than physically to kill a million people. Today, it is infinitely easier to kill a million people than to control a million people. It is easier to kill than to control.
Okay, I guess we need to follow that up with some scary music. Okay, in our last segment for tonight, we're going to look at a clip from Fox News piece on the swine flu vaccine. And this kind of fits in nicely with Zbigniew Brzezinski's statement there before about how easy it is to kill a million in comparison to controlling a million. In the piece, the doctor is saying that he believes that the vaccine is more dangerous than the disease. Now, as to whether this is actually part of a secret plan to kill millions of people, I don't know. But I think we should consider all possibilities at this point in time.
We are tracking H1N1, and health officials here in the U.S. saying it's too soon to know if a one-shot vaccine for the virus will actually be effective. The U.S. is working on an inoculation that requires two doses, although China and Switzerland recently announced they may have a one-dose version. We're told American officials will release their initial results from its vaccination studies and testing later this month. With me now, Dr.
Swine flu. In fact, if you had to choose, you'd probably choose at this point the swine flu over the regular seasonal flu.
Is that right? All right, now what do you think of the vaccination?
You know, I have more concern about the vaccine than I do about the swine flu. It's been rushed to market. There are high levels of adjuncts, which basically make it more potent, make so they can. It's kind of an unrefined method that they use. They had to use high levels of these adjuncts, including
thimerosal. It's an antiseptic preservative, and hasn't that been linked in some cases to autism?
It has, and you look, it's been shown to cause autism in children with mitochondrial dysfunction. Now, and other is controversial, though highly implicated. And the problem is you don't know if your child has mitochondrial dysfunction. I also worry about children and people who have blood-brain barrier dysfunction or it's not fully developed, which include children, pregnant women, chronic neurological illnesses, and chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia. Mm-hmm. I've seen these people been devastated by these infections.
All right, would you give it to your kids?
I definitely would not.
You would not, all right? And in fairness, I've talked to three doctors in 3 days now, and all three have said absolutely they would give it to their kids. They intend to give it to their kids. They're going to take it themselves, but you say no.
I definitely would not. I've seen it devastate people with chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, highly implicated, again, in autism. I think you're rolling the dice. It's a proven neurotoxin. Has 25,000 times the level of mercury than would be considered toxic if it was a food or a water.
Right.
And levels get up, serum levels up to 100 times the toxic level. It's too big of a risk.
All right. Dr. Kent Holtorf, an expert on infectious diseases. That's the other side. We've heard both sides now. Thank you so much.
And there we have it. A doctor, an expert, someone who clearly should be taken seriously, is saying that we have more to fear from the vaccine than the swine flu. Now, again, remember what Zbigniew Brzezinski said. we have reached a point in time when it is easier and more effective to kill a million people than to attempt to control them. We have seen plans to bring in mandatory vaccination in many Western countries, in many so-called democracies, including many parts of the United States, France, and the UK, and here in Australia. We actually have mandatory vaccination here for people who work in any kind of medical profession, including dentists. Now, who knows? You know, what we must question is the need to enforce a solution or a cure to an illness that, as the doctor said there, is less severe than normal flu. Now, it sounds ridiculous to assume that this might be part of some diabolical plan. Most diabolical plans do sound ridiculous because they are ridiculous. However, they have existed in history. And many times it has happened. And as we've seen with the Big Brother scenario, they assert that the level of crime has decreased dramatically. But the level of crime decreased dramatically when the fascists took over in Italy and Germany. Because, of course, if you have extreme laws, it will act as a deterrent. But what we've seen over and over again in human history is that the worst, the most egregious crimes of all are committed by those who hold all the power. Having power is it's a risk factor. The more power that is invested in one individual or in one entity in a society, the more risk there is that that power will be used ultimately for a criminal purpose. And so, sure, you can improve some aspects of street crime by bringing in a fascist totalitarian system. I don't doubt that. But what you also bring in is the possibility for crimes against humanity on a scale 1,000 times, perhaps 1,000,000 times greater than somebody getting mugged on the street. I mean, you bring in the possibility of mass extermination programs. And this has happened. It's happened over and over again. So those who say, oh, this is just a wild conspiracy theory, really need to go back and have a look at history. They need to look at what Mao did. They need to have a look at what Stalin did. They need to have a look at what Pol Pot did. They need to have a look at what Hitler did. They need to have a look at what happened in Eastern Europe in the last decade of the 20th century. The examples are so many that it is ridiculous and foolish in the extreme to assume that this cannot happen, because I guess, you know, we think maybe it cannot happen because we live in a free country. Well, it's only free if you stand up for your freedoms. If you allow the Big Brother system, which is now totally in control in the UK, if you allow that to take hold in Australia, if you surrender up your rights and your freedoms, if you offer that to the government on a platter, then you are also offering yourself up to be treated at the level of livestock. Okay, well, that about wraps it up for tonight's show. We have coming up, we'll be getting back into interviews, and This week, coming up this Wednesday, I'll be interviewing someone, an Australian, who's got really good scientific grounding in climate change. And I'm really looking forward to this interview because we're going to get to grips with the key questions. And, you know, as Kevin Rudd said, our policies must be grounded in the science. So we're going to really ground ourselves and we're going to examine Kevin Rudd's speech that we played to you earlier tonight and see if there's actually any shred of logic or science in it. I mean, obviously there's logic in it. I mean, he follows the logic of power and we know where they're heading with this. We know what they want to do. And we can examine the claims he makes about sea level rises and various other things and see if there's actually any sense to it at all, if there's any basis to it. I'm also planning to return to the subject of Chappelle Corby. We're going to do a series of interviews on Chappelle's situation, speaking to members of her family and other people. The next person we'll be speaking to is Sean Hatton, who is Chappelle's uncle, and he'll be coming on the show on the 7th of October, which will be roughly the 5th anniversary of Chappelle's incarceration in Bali. So another really important show coming up. And, of course, we'll be bringing you all the other news, and we'll be covering information about September 11 investigation and the upcoming conference, which is to be held in Sydney in under 2 months' time in November. And that's going to be a very exciting conference with some really important people coming. So looking forward to that. So, look, it's been an excellent night for me doing this show. It's taken a while to put this together. I hope you've enjoyed it. And I hope you return again next week. So on that note, I'll bid you good night and good luck from Truth News Radio Australia.